Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health. Hello and welcome to the next episode of ADHD Mums. Today we have, in this schooling episode mini-series, we have Tanya Waring back. How are you, Tanya?
I'm good. Thanks, Jane. How are you?
I'm good. I do feel like the mini-series is going to go forever because every time I do an episode, I extend it and do even more. We have Tanya back, and I don't know how long the mini-series will go because I've added in about 6 episodes since saying I was going to start it. So we are continuing on because there's so much to discuss. What we are doing today is Tanya's special area, which is reducing stress behaviors in the classroom, connection, co-regulation, and neuro-aware teaching, which is something we are all been looking for. Tanya, if somebody hasn't listened to the other episodes, one, they should. But two, if they haven't, could you give us a quick overview about who you are?
Sure. I had a good little summary of who I am. I'm not a school teacher and I'm not an expert in teaching in classrooms, but my background is in law and I did law for 22 years working in medico-legal litigation and complaints. And then I had to give that up to advocate and care for my third son, who is ADHD and autistic. And he has needed a lot more parenting than my other two boys. And he has needed a lot more support through the schooling system. I went back to uni and did my undergrad in psychology. Then I did my honours year. And now I'm doing my PhD in inclusive education, looking at some psych concepts, co-regulation, and applying them to the classroom and how it could be used in a classroom environment.
So in your experience, how much awareness do you think teaching staff have in terms of training?
Oh, I know that there's not enough training and I know there's not enough resources. That's 100% correct. And even pre-service teachers, there's no real requirement for instruction in relation to ADHD or autism or disability or inclusive practices. Most pre-service teachers are being taught how to teach content. And I know that's a common complaint that they arrive at their first job not having any information about how to respond to the wide variation of brain development that naturally occurs in the human condition. So not every kid is going to be up to the same thing. You need to be able to regulate your emotions in order to learn. So it's absolutely the case that there's not enough teaching about autism, ADHD, disability, inclusion.
So do you think that the lack of training is why so many teachers misinterpret stress behaviours as defiance, disrespect or laziness? Do you think that's part of it or how do you think that happens?
Absolutely. And look, we're all human. There's plenty of days where even knowing that my son is both autistic and ADHD, you just think, come on, my cup is not full enough for me to deal with you at this point in time. But that's the first part of co-regulation is the first thing you have to do is check your own regulation. Are you in a headspace where you're calm, rational, where you can respond with curiosity and kindness and empathy? Or are you feeling angry, agitated, anxious or frustrated? Because if that's your headspace, you are not going to be able to help that child regulate. You need to address that first. And I think that happens in the classroom all the time where teachers are already frustrated and then something happens and they're not coming to that with a calm approach. They're coming to that already with their heightened energy and their own frustration and anger. And that absolutely feeds into that child's response. If they are met with that, then they will keep escalating. And I promise you that there are kids like my son, he could escalate far more than I could as an adult. Kids will just keep going and going. So it's not the way to respond to a child who is starting to dysregulate. I thought I could tell you a bit about co-regulation because I think this is something that I talk to teachers about. And I usually begin with a bit of information about autism and ADHD, some basic facts that you on your show would have covered numerous times. That bears repeating because I think the more we hear it, the more we learn it, the more we know it. The Australian Bureau statistics reports that 9.5% of school-aged children have a disability that causes profound or severe limitations. So it's nearly 10%, right? And we know that with attention deficit hyperactive disorder, that for the child who is diagnosed with that, it's more than 8% of Australian children. They will have challenges typically with memory retrieval, planning, organisation, delayed emotion regulation skills, emotional impulsiveness. It's the most common mental disorder affecting Australian children at 8.3% and the most common diagnosis amongst boys at 11%. So that means 2 to 3 children in every classroom of 30 on average. Now, we know that's not quite the case because plenty of schools will not allow kids with ADHD and autism into their schools. So then you have, of course, state-based schools often have more kids with these diagnoses in their classrooms, but let's say on average 2 to 3 kids in every classroom. There is a myth that surrounds ADHD that it's a lack of good parenting. It's not really a real thing. It's a dietary problem. There is so much evidence. MRI studies comparing ADHD and non-ADHD brains found slower development in the areas of the brain responsible for impulse control, attention, and other executive functions. It's actually a brain disorder. So I think if you can understand that the rate of development of the brain of a child with ADHD is delayed compared to their peers, it does inform how you might respond to that child, because you come from a place of understanding that they're just not there yet. So they just don't have that capacity yet to manage those big emotions, and they need your help to do that for longer than their peers might. So lots of kids might be, by the time they get to grade 6, they might be ready to be relatively independently managing their emotions, and even when they get upset about something, be able to manage that in a socially acceptable way in a classroom environment. But there will be some kids with ADHD who just don't have the mental capacity to do that yet. Not that they will never have it, but just it takes them longer to develop those parts of their brains. So there's MRI evidence of that. There's also a myth that it's overdiagnosed, which is quite an interesting thing, because I think that there would be psychiatrists, pediatricians and psychologists who would say that some children are diagnosed with it because their parents want them to have the medication to improve their performance at school, particularly in later years of high school. I think that is the experience that we're seeing. But then there is an underdiagnosis of kids whose families can't afford to get a diagnosis, or whose families are still unhappy with the label being attached to their child, or whose families are not in a position to explore that for any number of reasons. So there are still children who get through the system who are not diagnosed, particularly among women, among girls, because it might appear differently and not as externally as lots of boys.
So when we talk about teacher education, my kids went to a private school for only a bit over a year. And we left that not because I had a problem with private schooling, but because just with the NAPLAN and in terms of the amount of pressure and academic performance, it didn't really fit with us as a family and about what I thought was important. And so we chose to leave that school. However, when we were at that school, I made friends with a couple of the teachers, and there were some really great teachers there. And they would go ahead and do these professional development days. And I would say to them as a bit of a joke, oh, I can't believe I have to pay private school fees to have my kids at home more because of all of your professional development days, ha, ha, ha. And they would respond back and say, oh, we're actually really dreading it. We are going on this Christian retreat and we're doing this meditation and that's all great, but we're actually desperate for some education around autism, ADHD, because we have a huge amount in our school, but we actually don't know what to do with them. And we actually would love to do some training, but we can't because we are doing a lot of these religious-based studies, which some of them weren't really that religious. I was just wondering, with teacher education, is inclusion neurodiversity-affirming practice actually required by law, or is it like an extra that the school can do if they want?
I don't think it's required by law. The policy as a lawyer was that we had to do 10 hours a year in order to keep our registration as a lawyer. That is not the case, so far as I'm aware, for teachers. There's probably KPIs that schools have to meet, but there wouldn't be a legal requirement, and certainly not as specific as doing education in ADHD and autism. It would just be professional development and then up to the schools to work out what that might look like.
I just think that's interesting because I know you've got obviously multiple degrees in psychology, as do I. And, you know, I've just noticed that they have that neuroaffirming requirement now. So psychologists must go and do neuroaffirming training, and that is mandatory now to maintain registration. And I wonder if we get into a point where teachers may be, well, the schools
wouldn't
may have to provide. Like, wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, that would be good. And a policy worth lobbying for with local members of parliament.
Well, when we talk about the change that needs to happen in the education system, what is one change we can actually ask for? I see change petitions come out. They've got all these signatures. That's great. But what are we asking for? And I think neuroaffirming training would be a great start. What do you think?
Oh, I think it'd be a great start. I'd also like to see suspension and expulsion are no longer allowed. because that would force then the hand of schools to change what they're doing in the classroom so that if they know that they can't push a child out, then I think that would change things. But yeah, look, mandatory training in neuroaffirming teaching would be amazing.
And I think that would sort out some of those things we've been talking about, like expulsion, suspension, segregating, because within neuroaffirming, you just can't do that.
That's right.
And I mean, skilling the teachers up, because my hubby and I had a really interesting thing where we really fundamentally disagreed in a particular area of parenting, which was timeouts. I fundamentally disagreed with timeouts working. I remember being timed out as a kid, and I wrote on a piece of paper for 3 hours how much I hated my whole family. And I didn't feel any better about the whole thing when I came out. In fact, I actually stayed in my room for the rest of the day because I was like, I'm not coming out now. I don't believe, my personal opinion, that timeouts work. He believes they do. But we really had to go through that skill up period because you can't just take away something that somebody does and then they don't know what else to do.
Yeah.
So I think the neuroaffirming training would actually build some of those skills, because I don't think the teachers are thinking, well, if I can't expel or suspend, what can I do?
100%. And I agree with you completely. And that's the problem, of course, that we're seeing when you've got leadership saying, oh, okay, well, the policy is now, it's an absolute last resort to suspend or expel. And of course, what's required is more resources in the classroom, more understanding and awareness about ADHD and autism and brain development and co-regulation and relationship building. And the one thing that I think that all teachers can do, regardless of whatever training they've got, if they take away from this podcast that what I can do in the classroom is build a positive relationship with all of the kids in my classroom, that would be one massive step towards getting better outcomes for kids with ADHD and autism. The more you get to know a child with a positive mindset, the better that relationship's going to be, the more you're going to be able to work with that child to help them develop their emotion regulation skills and reduce meltdowns in the classroom. The same can be, like, you talk about timeouts. I would also talk about dojo points. I would talk about behavior ladders. I would talk about marbles in the jar for good behavior and marbles out of the jar for bad behavior. And that kind of reward and punishment system was developed by psychologists working with dogs. Humans are far more complicated than that. And reward and punishment is only going to take us so far. And it certainly doesn't address the problem. It's not a motivational issue. ADHD does have motivational issues, but it's not meltdowns and behavior in the classroom is not a motivational issue. That is a distress signal. It is about, I'm not coping, I'm not doing well, and I need help to manage these big emotions. So having reward and punishment systems is not going to address that situation. You actually, as the adult, need to understand more about what's going on for that child, and you need to bring to that relationship with that child positivity, curiosity, empathy, kindness, things that I think that all humans, like, you go into teaching, you want to have a classroom full of happy kids who are happy learning and progressing their education at whatever rate they can. in a relatively peaceful way. That's what teachers all want. They don't want to come to work and have conflict with kids. They want to come to work and enjoy being in the classroom. But as the person with the most power in that classroom, it's really on the adult in that classroom to lead and to build those relationships and to get to know each child and to understand what's going on for each child. When you do that, then you're going to have a far easier time in the long term, because that child will trust you and that child will not be living in a state of constant fight or flight. And that's what happens. If a child feels that you don't like them, if a child feels that you're going to be unfair towards them, then they will be constantly anxious that you are going to punish them for something that they don't even know that they've done wrong, or that they can't control, or that you're going to humiliate them by making them, oh, okay, because little Billy over there's not sitting still, we're going to take 5 marbles out of that jar. Oh, now everyone misses out on an icy pole at the end of the term. That doesn't work. And we know it doesn't work, so stop doing it. But the first thing that you can do to address what's going on in a classroom is to have better relationships with the kids.
You know, a metaphor I've been thinking about for a while, and please let me know if you don't agree with this. I have one child that can be quite disruptive. And what I've really found with him is I've got to really invest the time up front with him. And that's every day. That's every day is a new day. Sometimes I need to invest the time 3 to 4 times a day, depending on what day I have. I know that if I don't do this, it's going to be a long, difficult day. It's hard to be a mum of a neurodivergent child at times, because it is taxing, because I can't have a cup of tea and switch off in the morning and have a break, because I know if I do that, I'm going to have a long day, just to put it lightly. So what I've been actually thinking in the morning is I've been taking on the persona of a sporting coach. I'm obsessed with netball. I'm hardcore into my netball. And I was like, right, I think for me, motherhood is basically a sports coach role. Everyone has different needs. I have to have everybody on side contributing, including my husband. If I have somebody that doesn't feel a part of the team, that doesn't feel heard, that I don't have a relationship with, that's feeling fractured with me, the coach, I've got trouble on my hands. They stir the other ones up and I ask them to do something they won't. And I have this whole escalation that happens from not being connected to the coach. So I was wondering, in terms of teaching, and this might be a bit out there, but when we're talking about getting kids on board and investing that relationship with them and connecting with them, I love what you're saying. Do you think that coaching role fits what you're talking about?
Well, it does. And when I talk about co-regulation, one of the elements of that is that coaching role. And coaching means I'm showing you how to do what I'm asking you to do by doing it with you. So I'm keeping myself regulated. So I'm taking my breaths, I'm walking away for a minute, I'm coming to the start of the day with my regulated self, and I'm going to help you, depending on the age of the child, identify the emotion, talk through the options of distraction, diversion, reframing, thinking about the situation differently, problem solving, all those things. I'm going to walk that with you. You are their coach. And that is part of the role of the teacher as well, is they are coaching kids all day long, in the sense that they are teaching them how to learn, they're teaching them content, they're teaching them behaviours in the classroom by leading those behaviours, which goes both ways, right? So if they're going to attack a child who is not doing well, who is in distress, is vulnerable, they are coaching the other kids, this is how we treat people who are not doing well. But if I, as a teacher, respond to that child with myself regulated, identify, I can see you're not doing well, buddy. Your face is all red. You're not doing what I've asked you to do. And I know you want to do what I've asked you to do. What can we do here? Do you need to go for a walk? What are you feeling? You're taking on that coaching role. You're being curious. You're being kind. You're being empathic. And you're coaching them, because in time, they will learn to do that for themselves. I'm not feeling well. My heart's racing. I can feel the sweat. Why am I not feeling well? I've got too much on my plate. So you're teaching them what they need to do in the fullness of time on their own without you there. That's what parents do with their little kids. That's what teachers do with little kids. as they age, that changes. And I'm actually looking at co-regulation in high school environments. So I think it needs to continue for longer than it does, particularly for kids with ADHD and autism because of that delayed brain development. But there's a lot of work that's done with preschool and early primary years teaching that is about that coaching, teaching them how to socialise and be social in the classroom and how to meet expectations in the classroom. So coaching is definitely part of our roles as parents, and it's part of the role of a teacher as well. Absolutely.
Oh, I love that. So if we move into stress behaviours, then this is funny because it's in parenting as well and also in schools, but if we have a stress behaviour, which you've spoken about, how is that different from intentional misbehaviour, a bad attitude, defiance? Like, where is the line between those two?
I don't know that particularly helpful, because you're not going to know until you ask the question, are you? So if you're getting behaviour which is not expected, which is not meeting your expectations, you're not going to know what's behind that behaviour until you are curious about that behaviour. And if you really want to understand what's going on for that child who's producing that behaviour, then you need to come with genuine curiosity and, importantly, genuine positive regard. So you need to afford that child a genuine belief that they're doing their best, and not assuming that it's a bad attitude, not assuming that it's malicious, not assuming that it's defiance. What is going on that this is how you're behaving? That you're not going to know until you ask the questions. Depending on the age of the child, they may not be able to articulate that easily. So you need to hold some space for them to work that out. Or with my son now, who's older, because we've held space for him so much over time, he does come to me and he will tell me, "I'm sorry about blah, blah, the way I spoke earlier." And he'll go into some really great detail about what's been on his mind, like why he's been in a bit of a state about things. And that hasn't happened by accident. That's happened because we have spent so much time holding space for him over the years and being genuinely curious about what's going on, mate, that you are so upset. For many years, he just couldn't articulate it. But now he's able to really amazingly articulate things. So he's becoming quite a high emotional intelligence guy. And I do want to give you a bit of hope about your early mornings.
Please.
It changes. It's all the work that you're doing, all the effort you're putting into understanding your child, prioritizing that relationship with him. Nothing is more important than the relationship. Nothing. So whatever has happened can be dealt with, but the very first thing you have to deal with is, are you okay, mate? They might have just done something really awful, like punched someone or thrown a computer. The first thing is, are you okay? That might be enough for them to just lose all that anger and just come right back down to grief because of what they've just done. That really is the only way to go about changing the behavior and helping that child produce behavior that's going to enable them to participate in the long run in work environments, social environments, society in general. That will give them the very best shot at doing all of that is preserving that relationship amongst, and then being curious about what is happening. I've said this to groups of teachers before, and I don't think kids are not malicious. We can all be defiant at times. It's a human characteristic, but kids don't come to school wanting to upset everyone. It just isn't the case. And we have to not forget that. We have to remember that kids want to do well. Like Ross Green says, kids do well when they can, and they do. We're at a stage now with my 16-year-old where we have come from needing carers from 6:30 a.m. until 8 a.m. to get us through the morning routine, plus two parents at home. So two parents, like my husband couldn't go to work until we went to school, and often he had to take him to school. I was on at the other end of the phone waiting for the school to call me, so available to pick him up at any time. And then we had carers in the afternoon, depending on what time we got home from school, but any time from 12 noon till 3 until 6 o'clock at night. So we had carers at both ends of the day just to get through the day with two other, just enormous needs. And we are now at a point where we have a carer in the afternoon for a couple of hours, really to build his confidence in the community. So to build his social engagements more than anything. And it is about building his independence, but that's it. And we have a very quiet, easy start to the day. But in the same way that you've created an environment at home by moving into the country, getting into a bit of land, we did the same for our child. So we changed our living environment to create a really quiet space at home. And in fact, we have been living over two places in order just to give him some space to decompress. And that's been a big part of helping him really come out of that fight or flight place that he was living in, that high anxiety, ready to fight or flee, into his frontal cortex where he is so much more capable of reasoning, of being reasonable. His planning and memory and all those things are developing in a much more productive way, and we can see real change in his capacity for emotion regulation, for learning, for meeting expectations at home and at school. And he's getting more energy to be challenged to extend himself a bit. So it's been a long process, but worthwhile. We're seeing real change. And I want to give you hope because it does improve. You're putting in so much effort, it will pay off.
Oh, yeah. I hope so. So if we strip it right back, because a lot of people may not understand what co-regulation actually is, how is co-regulation different from just calming a child down?
Okay, that's a really good question. I'm going to answer it in two parts. I'm first going to explain emotion regulation. So there's a lot of research about this, like just thousands and thousands and thousands of papers. And James Gross is an American professor who is the sort of father of the research into emotion regulation. So emotion regulation is, there's four parts to it. We identify a situation and we attend to that situation. We appraise the situation and then we respond to it. So that's sort of a four-step process. I mean, it happens in the blink of an eye, and that's what we're doing all day. So we notice things, we appraise them, and then we respond to them. So that, by breaking it down that way, it gives us four opportunities essentially to help a child regulate. So if you know that they're not going to do well in an assembly situation, in an undercover area which is very loud and busy and they have to sit still, then you know that situation's not going to be great for them and their ability to manage their emotions. So you might, as the teacher, take the decision to talk about it with the child and work out a solution. Now, that solution might be that they are at the back of the assembly where they can go for a walk if they need to, or they might go to the butterfly room or wherever to avoid assemblies, but you can come up with a solution. And then there's attending to it. So if you can see that a child is becoming dysregulated, then another opportunity might be to divert their attention to something else. Appraising the situation, that's when you might help a child reframe the situation. So it might not be catastrophic. It might actually be that this is another way of looking at the situation. And by doing that with them, you're helping them to learn to do that for themselves. And the response, when you're trying to help them modulate their response, instead of screaming or crying, or you might try and help them find another way to process their emotions about that situation. So that's emotion regulation in a really quick nutshell. Co-regulation requires, first and foremost, a positive relationship. A stranger is unlikely to be able to assist a child to regulate if they see, maybe, but in a classroom situation, the better a teacher knows a child, the better they're going to be able to co-regulate with that child, because they're going to be able to anticipate situations that might cause problems. They're going to be able to see the child noticing a situation. They're going to be able to help the child reframe the situation to be more positive or distract them. And they're going to be able to help them modulate their response to the situation. So relationship is everything. It's also about the environment, because as a teacher, you can create an environment that enables kids to regulate their emotions better. If a child doesn't do well in a noisy, busy environment, they might need headphones, they might need breaks, but you problem solve that with the child that you're getting to know, because each situation and each child will be different. But you have control over the environment to a large extent. So there are things that you can do in your classroom. So as Ross Green says, you problem solve these things together. That's his whole plan B approach, is to work with the child and work out things that might help them regulate their emotions better. Coaching, as we talked about earlier, you're demonstrating to them how to go about this business of regulating their response to things and regulating those big emotions. You're breathing with them. You might go over and get down to their level and be curious about what's going on, mate, and get them thinking about, why am I so upset? You're teaching them in this coaching role all day, every day, how you manage emotions, how you manage situations that make you feel certain ways. So that's a big part of the role. You're a coach in that classroom. And you're not just teaching that one child. You're teaching all those other kids, because all those other kids are watching you and how you're dealing with a child who's in crisis or who is distressed for some reason. And I should have said this first. The most important thing is that you, as the adult, are regulated. So co-regulation can't happen if you are feeling frustrated and angry. And I challenge you to do something. As part of my parenting, I used to record my son having meltdowns until he would catch me recording it and then either try to destroy my phone or it would just escalate him beyond beliefs. But it's an interesting process, because it really makes you reflect on how well you're doing at this really important role of co-regulating with kids who are not doing well in the classroom. And I learned a lot about myself in that process. I thought I was doing so much better than I was, and it really brought home to me how much more I needed to do. And I think that's a big thing, is that none of this happens overnight. There's no quick fix. You have to learn these skills in the same way these kids have to learn these skills. So you have to learn to be regulated even when you don't feel like, even when you are upset, you have to learn to, I'm the adult. I know he is not doing well in this moment, and he needs me to be regulated, and he needs me to care about him. Big breath, mate. And I know my son well enough now that I can say, I think that you're actually not upset with me about this or this. I think you're grieving this or this. I'm thinking of a particular situation. And it totally deflated him, because he realized he was grieving the loss of time with friends and blah, 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 because of all the things that have gone on. And it is a real skill to take a breath and pick yourself up and be the adult and just expect that they are doing their best, genuine positive regard, be curious what is going on, and help them reframe the situation, regulate their emotions, distract them, all those things in that coaching. Like, it's so important. If you want to change behavior, then you play the long game, and that's what you have to do.
I love that. What I was wondering, in the classroom, as an example, what would co-regulation look like? If you could wave a magic wand and be like, this child needs help, they need to regulate their emotions, this is what a teacher would do.
Well, this is where I'm at, partnering with teachers to get their specific classroom experiences, because in the research, it looks like you need more resources. You need, because they've got 30 kids, and getting kids started on a subject, but then making time to respond to the child who's not doing well would obviously be a process that would be so much assisted by having a second person in the classroom. Lots of classrooms, especially early on in the year, there is more opportunity to spend a bit more time with each child. I guess the idea would be by investing in relationships early up, minimizing that becoming a really big time consuming issue, and one that just, hey, are you checking in with them? Are you doing okay? Is there something happening that you need some help with? Nipping things in the bud so that they're less time consuming, but more resourcing would be a great help to that process in the long run. And one thing that I have mentioned consistently when I'm talking to teachers is the beginning of the day, every kid that walks into your classroom, how are you going? Say their name, welcome them into the classroom, and have a few minutes at the beginning of the day where you just pick a few people, how was your weekend? So you're just getting to know them minute by minute, day by day, just those little minutes of opportunity. But the first 5 or 10 minutes of every day is greeting, welcoming, and getting to know your kids so that if something's going on, you are in it and aware of it. Like I think in primary school, that's a really great way to build those positive relationships and to get ahead of not just in a crisis, but co-regulating all the time. You're identifying opportunities where things are just starting to look like they're not on track, so you work out how to get them back on track again. I think avoiding the crisis situation by using co-regulation in your interactions with kids all day, every day.
Oh, I love that. What about if we look at what would be a few small doable changes that you think teachers or a teacher's aide could implement to support students better in the area of co-regulation?
My first thing would be to greet every child every day. I just think that's a really easy thing to do. Everyone likes to hear the teacher say their name in a kind way. So to start every day like that and to spend a few minutes each day, perhaps not with the same kids, but which kids you do definitely need to get to know. So start with them, but then you can put a minute or two with each kid, like just a little story with each kid.
Connection, I suppose, is your main
absolutely
message.
Relationships,
that.
Yep.
What about for parents? So last question. So how could a parent advocate for that connection or for that co-regulation? Let's say someone listens to this episode and they think, wow, that's what I've been thinking. You've put into words what I wanted to say. I felt like I was going insane because it's such a out-of-the-box request for the school. They're not really, I suppose, open to hearing that. They're more into rewards and punishment, let's say. How could parents advocate for that kind of relationship? What kind of things could they say or do that isn't going to look like they're criticizing the teacher?
Well, I have gotten into the habit of, even this year, I get an email home saying, oh, he didn't follow the plan. Now, that wasn't actually correct. What do you suggest? They hadn't done anything that I'd suggested before, like get to know him, spend 5 minutes with him and get to build that relationship with him. So that's what I'd emailed and still, what do you suggest? And they hadn't, I asked her, have you spent any time with him? And this is week 3. No, not yet. Now, she's the only teacher that he has. Like, I just think, what do you mean? Like, there's 25 kids in the classroom. Like, he's the only new kid. Week 3, and you still haven't spent 5 minutes just having a chat with him. Like, all we can do is keep repeating the obvious. The more my child trusts you and the more he feels that you like him, all kids want to be liked. They all want to be loved. They want to go into the classroom and feel welcome and liked. That you as the adult have to find something in common with this kid. You just have to find something. They'll tell you pretty quickly what they're interested in if they're ADHD or autistic, because there's no real secrets there. Like, they'll come out with it and then you just go with that. Like, you know, if they're into Greek mythology, then ask them about it and maybe go and have a look at something and build a discussion around it. So relationship is everything. If I could, what I wish I had done earlier on. I just find all those plans that are so detailed that nobody reads and nobody follows. The thing that I think is most important is that you believe that my child is doing their best, that you afford them genuine positive regard, and that you build a relationship with them. And if you build that relationship with them, then you will have a much better chance of working out how to support him when he's not doing well. Because you'll know that when he was younger, he was into swords and all sorts of battle stuff. Then you might have something in the classroom that you can use to distract him, to get him, help him calm those big emotions and think about something else. So the more you know him, the better chance you've got of supporting him through those difficult moments.
Well, that's great. So in terms of practical steps moving forward, let's say you are being asked to come in for an IEP meeting, let's say, and I know I'm trying to finish up, it's a quick one. Should then in that plan, because I actually really agree with what you're saying there, because if you have all the intricate things, like no one's going to read it anyway. So it's like, why are we spending an hour doing that? And I mean, obviously this is different for everybody, but in some cases, is it better to strip it back and be like, fundamentally, the connection is really important. And fundamentally, I just want you to do these two things, which are around maybe building a connection with my child or whatever you think it is, rather than having the 5-minute break here and the red card means that and 5 extra minutes over here. Because my experience is the same. It doesn't get read anyway. And it's like, well, why did I spend an hour and a half? I don't know why I did.
And as the teacher, you have control. So if you think based on your relationship with this kid that they need to go walk to the office to deliver an empty note to the principal to walk back again because they need a 5-minute break, then that's what you can do. You can control. You don't need a piece of paper to tell you to do that. You can find a way for them to have a 5-minute break. You can say, do you want to go and get a drink at the Bubblers, mate? You have those tools at your disposal, which you can use. So get to know the kid and work out what's going to work in that moment to help them turn their attention elsewhere. So distract them, reframe the situation, modulate their response to the situation, and choose a different situation. So change the environment in some way. So if you know those things, then you can use those, whatever tools you think will help in discussion with that child, because the child can help you. You can problem solve those things together.
Absolutely. And if you know the child, then you know when they're escalating. Maybe they don't need the 5-minute break that day. Maybe they're really
100%.
Happy.
Yeah.
Maybe they need 10 minutes the next day because it's fluctuating. But you would then know because you have a connection with the child. And hopefully if you have a connection with the child and you're a teacher, you may really love kids and maybe it's easy for you to give them a positive regard if you actually have listened to them talk about dinosaurs or ponies or whatever it is that they're into.
That's right.
Because I think getting to know an autistic kid is really easy. It's so easy. Oh, my God, you just got to listen. Just go, hey, what do you think about Greek mythology, and it's 15 minutes later, all you gotta do is figure out how to nicely finish the conversation. That's really about it.
100%.
And they're happy. You don't even have to really say anything. Just listen and nod and be interested.
That's right. And you know who can help you kick that off if you're stuck? Oh, the parents. There are ways in with kids and you've just got to find them. And once you kick off that relationship and your understanding about ADHD and your understanding about autism, they can inform the things that you might think about to respond in any given scenario as it unfolds in a dynamic way, which is the nature of development and kids and growth.
It'd be pretty rewarding as well for a teacher if you were able to crack a kid that was
absolutely
crackable, wouldn't it?
Like, absolutely.
I'd be pretty pumped if I was a teacher and there was a child that all the other teachers didn't want in their class.
Yep.
They were really segregated and you were actually able to engage that kid. What a win. That would happen.
Oh, 100%. One of the teachers I spoke to had, there was a kid known in the school, wasn't even in her classroom, and she thought, I am going to crack that kid. That's pretty much what she said too. And every day in the playground, she knew he was into something, but every day she would say hello to him. She would reach it like just, and eventually he would start responding. It took her months, but she kept, once she realized he liked this thing, she said, oh, look, I've brought something to school. Come and I'll show you. And he eventually went and she showed him whatever it was. And then from then on, every time this kid was having a really hard time in his class or whatever, he would run out and come and find her classroom. She's a lower primary school teacher, and she would let him play with this thing. And that became a coping mechanism for him. All kids are crackable because they're still little people. They're still little people who are developing and who are growing. And if we want them to have positive growth and development, then it's for the adults to invest in those relationships and help them along that path, you know. And she was, this teacher really loved this kid, and he still keeps in contact with her. He's a young man now and ended up leaving school in grade 9 or something, so didn't do well in high school. But he adored her.
And how much would that have meant to him?
If he sees her in the shops or whatever, always comes up to her to, hey, miss, how are you going? And incredibly rude. Like, she was very teary when she was telling me about him. Like, honestly, they're the ones who touch your heart.
Particularly if they don't necessarily have active parents either.
I think his parents really cared about him, but they were just under-resourced.
Yeah, and a lot of people, times are hard. People are working full time. Both parents are still struggling.
Yeah.
So it's very stressful. So that is a great way to finish up. Thank you so much for your time, Tanya. This has been such a great episode. I think people are going to get a lot from it. Thank you very much for your time. I'm going to send you an email through with all of the information that you've given me over the last two episodes to put in the show notes.
I'll be partnering with teachers. So that's the next stage of my research. But look, anyone who has questions about emotion regulation, co-regulation, that sort of thing, I'm very happy to go and talk to schools about ADHD, autism, emotion regulation, minimizing stress behaviors in the classroom. That's something that I love to do, and I'm very happy to keep doing that.
Okay. So for anybody who's listening, Tanya is located in Brisbane.
Yep.
And I will put Tanya's contact details in the show notes, but I'll also put the Jot form for listener questions. We'll either get Tanya back if all of the questions are similar and it's one theme, then I'll just do a podcast episode about it with those questions. Or otherwise, we might get you back on a bit of a panel. We'll see how we go.
Terrific.
But regardless, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Jane. Thanks for all the work you're doing in this area. It's so important. We have to lift our voices to get change, real change.
We do. Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD Mums shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au,